You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
Many of us seem to get stuck in paralysis by analysis, whether that be with our investments, our strategy for life, real estate, you know, whatever it is. So many of us just get stuck trying to make sure everything is perfect and never take action. Our guest today, Ziana McIntyre, is the exact opposite of that. This is someone that dove headfirst, without any like background in real estate, dove headfirst into the Airbnb space. Frankly, probably when it was still the Wild West. But through that iterative learning process has polished a system that so many other people are now looking at and trying to replicate. We thought we could bring her on the show today, go behind the scenes and really find out how she started this journey, what actionable advice she could give to our audience, and where she's going into the future with her systems that she's been able to put in place over the last 5 or 6 years. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing quite well. And yeah, this should be a really good episode. You and I actually had the good fortune of meeting Ziana 2 years ago at Camp Mustache. This was when Choose FI was just actually starting. And we got to learn a little bit about her and hear about this amazing Airbnb system that she set up. And we realized this would be the perfect episode to bring to the audience because people are really genuinely interested in learning about real estate. And while you and I have minimal experience with real estate investing, there are many, many people in the FI community that have that experience. And this Airbnb take is really incredibly intriguing to me. So with that, Ziana, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, guys. I'm really excited.
So what's so funny about that is you say that, you know, we have minimal experience and you are absolutely right. But what's striking about Ziana's story is before she was a hardcore real estate investor, Ziana, before you were a hardcore real estate investor, you also had minimal experience. And, you know, you kind of look through what's going on in the area and you say, well, you know, with Brad and myself, some of our limitations, well, we're in a, you know, the real estate here, it's not like a prime market. You're in Colorado, also kind of like a, you know, a probably not a ton of buying opportunities there either, but you don't let that kind of limiting belief of, oh, well, I don't know anything about real estate and this isn't like somewhere in the Midwest where all the deals are, stop you from getting started. Like, help place us in time. How did your real estate journey begin?
Yeah, I think I've always been interested in homes. And, you know, like when I go to someone's house and they want to show me around, I'm like the first one asking for a tour. Like, I just love that. I want to know how people live and how they're different and everything. So I've always had that fascination. And I think I thought that might turn into being like a real estate agent or something when I was younger, but it didn't go that route. So I think I've always had it in the back of my mind that like, I was going to try to figure out how people do that. And I think like also from reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad, when I was pretty young, I thought, okay, like real estate sounds like a way to get wealth in your life. And so I wanted to learn about that. And neither of my parents really knew anything or owned property. So I didn't have like a childhood home that I grew up in. So I knew it was kind of like on my back to learn that. But yeah, I mean, I did the Airbnb thing before I actually owned anything. So that experience, I guess, kind of dovetailed into feeling a little more sure and comfortable about buying a home and knowing I could cover the costs.
Okay. So I guess we should start with that. So, you know, when I think about one of the things about Airbnb is it's a nice way to dip your toe into kind of this landlord experience without having any sort of long-term commitments that you're dealing with. You own a home and you potentially rent out a room in your home and you try it out and they're like, oh, wow, this is great. And then you scale it up. But that's not what you did.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I did something similar. So I was renting a 2-bedroom apartment and I had an extra room and I had a roommate who moved away and I could have just gotten another roommate, but it was already furnished. And I had a friend in New York City who had been doing Airbnb for about a year and telling me how much he loved it. And so I was like, well, let's just try it. Like my lease said that I could sublet, and I just felt like, okay, cool. Let's just see if I like it. If I don't like it, I'll just get a roommate, you know, no big deal. And I found over time that, you know, I had spent a lot of time doing couch surfing in my travels and having people in my home and hosting, and I loved that. And if people are not familiar with Couchsurfing, it's a little less popular now, but it's a website where you can kind of open your home, put people on your couch or wherever, and they stay with you for free. And I traveled a lot with that. I hosted a lot of people with that. And I love just like showing people my town and taking them around. So with Airbnb, it was like the best of both worlds because I got to have this like cool couch surfer person that went on hikes with me and we went out and explored. But then at the same time, they were paying like more than my roommate would. And so I could live off of it. And it took out that huge chunk of what housing costs.
So, okay. I'm curious about the numbers of this and like kind of how deliberate you were at that point. So this is your first real estate venture, if you will, right? And I guess as I'm understanding it, you have a lease for this 2-bedroom place. You're allowed to sublet. And you previously had a roommate who certainly defrayed some of the costs of this total lease. You decided to do Airbnb. Did you run through the numbers? Was this, okay, if I'm paying X percent to Airbnb and there's Y percent vacancy rate, did you go through all that at the beginning? Or was this just a fun experiment to see like, okay, let's try this for a couple of months and see what happens?
Yeah, so I think my rent was like $1,175, somewhere close to $12. And I was paying $525 and the roommate was paying like $725. Because I had it furnished already and she moved into that. And so I was already kind of leveraging the rent with what I had provided. So I was like, well, I wonder if I could just cover more of it. And I didn't run all the numbers because I didn't have much to compare it with. This was 2012. And my friend who was telling me about it was from New York City. And so there was just way more demand there for travelers than Boulder. Like, I just didn't expect Boulder to blow up in the way that it has now. Now it's like a huge demand market for Airbnb. But at the time, most people didn't even know what it was if I mentioned Airbnb. And so there wasn't a lot of traffic. And so, yeah, I was just kind of playing with the numbers. I think I had the pricing ranging from like $45 to $75 a night. And I was just getting a couple of nights here and there. But it worked out really well because with a roommate, I would get annoyed with them. You know, we would have like cleaning issues and whatnot. But with an Airbnb guest, I would have somebody for a week. And then by the time I could get annoyed with them or bothered, they'd be gone already. And I could block off schedules of time and then not have anybody and have the place to myself and still cover the same cost. So it seemed like a really good situation.
Yeah. I mean, how quickly do you determine, okay, this makes sense. Like, I don't need to look for another roommate. Was it something you came to relatively quickly or did you test for 3 to 6 months or something?
Yeah. So I started around, I want to say it was August. What I've learned now is that the summertime is a bigger season, especially in this area, but just in general, most people travel in the summer. I was going from that kind of higher season into the low season, but it was still enough to cover it. And I mean, this was still really bare bones. Like nowadays, if you've got an apartment, you can make, you know, 2 times market rate plus. So it definitely makes a lot of sense in many areas. But at that time, it was really just that I saw that I was covering more than she was, sometimes covering all of my rent. And I just knew that like, okay, from just having some experience in the personal finance world, I was kind of getting into Mr. Money Mustache and stuff like that at that time. I thought, okay, if I can cover this huge amount that I spend on housing, then I have so much more freedom. Maybe I wouldn't have to work or I can work just a little bit here and there. And so it was just working me towards my goal. So it wasn't really like a trial and error. It was just like, I've started doing it and it's working. So then how can I expand it?
Yeah. And it strikes me that one of the things you kind of had in the background was almost the freedom to fail with this. I mean, it was kind of a low risk proposition for you to do this. And were you in a career at this particular point in time? Did you have a great income? Like, what was going on in the background?
I was pretty young. I want to say it was like 26 or 5, something like that. And I was going to massage school. So it was like changing careers, but I didn't really have a career before that. I was kind of just doing fun jobs here and there. I was like a tour guide. And so at the time of being in massage school, I was working minimum wage. Maybe it was $12 an hour. That's higher than minimum wage. But I was just kind of working at a retail shop. and it was no big deal. And I think the Airbnb seemed like just this side thing that I was only doing while I was in college just to like get through. So I really thought that like, I'm going to do massage and that's going to be my whole gig. So yeah, it's so funny how the massage dropped off. Like I did that for a couple of years at the same time as Airbnb, but it's really that Airbnb grew into my full-time life.
Ziana, so I'm curious, how did you find Mr. Money Mustache in the FI community? I mean, as you're describing it, you had just a bunch of odd jobs. You're learning about Airbnb. Where did this all come together? And you mentioned the word goal in there. Were there explicit goals? Talk me through your mindset at this point in time.
Both of my parents weren't really good with money. So I kind of grew up in a money insecure environment. And I saw the ups and downs of like the struggle and hardship. And I knew that I didn't want that, but I didn't quite understand the complications of adult life and like why it would be that way. So my mom kind of started getting into personal finance a little bit when I was going to college. So just about like 18. And so we would watch like Susie Orman show together and that kind of thing. I used that to kind of learn some basic concepts about just like paying down debt and snowballing and all that. But as you know, Susie is like very, you know, mainstream basic, and I don't follow her principles anymore. But at about 2011, before I moved to Boulder, so before I was going to massage school, I was kind of traveling around with a boyfriend and I found Mr. Money Mustache blog. So I was already kind of in the space reading about personal finance. And when I found him, like right when he was starting, I just latched on. Pete was my guru. And I just had the same goal as him. I was like, you know what? I can just adopt his goal, which was $600,000 and a paid off place to live. You know, I was working through student loan debt and all that, but I just figured, okay, let's just hold on to this. And I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to just keep trying and live really frugally and take his tips and keep reading the blog. So I had that in the back of my mind when I was starting this Airbnb thing. And that's what made me think like, wow, okay, if I can cover all my housing, that's my biggest expense. Then the next biggest thing is transportation. If I can bike more and whatnot, then I'm in a pretty good spot.
That's so awesome. Let's talk about that next step. So you've effectively figured out how to live for free. You've even upgraded the house hacking component where you don't even own the house and you're still able to pull this off. So many different elements there to kind of work our way through, but your life has become very inexpensive and that's afforded you an extreme level of flexibility and the freedom to fail. How do you scale that? Like, because I know you now have several properties, you're going and now you're looking at getting a second property. Is this now going to be a primary residence? Like, what's the plan here?
I still didn't have that much money because it was really early days and it just wasn't producing a ton, but I knew it was enough to cover rent. So I went looking for another place and I asked my dad for a loan. And he gave me like $4,000 for like rent and security deposit and then like some furniture for this new place. And so when I rented another place, I planned to like go back and forth and sort of live between the two, because the step between that was that I was renting the one bedroom in my place. Then I was starting to rent my bedroom at the same time. So I was like renting both. And then I got to a place where I was staying with friends a lot and taking them to breakfast because they were letting me stay and doing different trades.
We'll work something
trades.
Out. Yep.
Totally. Yeah. It was a little bit like, okay, I'm kind of homeless. So like it would be awesome to have another place and then just kind of go between the two based on like what books. At that time, I was able to quit my retail job. And so I was willing to like do the hustle and kind of deal with the like ungroundingness of traveling back and forth. Cause I was sort of living out of a suitcase all the time based on, you know, whatever books that takes like high priority and I'm just going to move. And at the time I was also doing all the cleaning, which was cool because it was like maybe $40 a clean or something. So that was like good money for me to make like $35 or $40 an hour. So, I mean, there's different elements in the Airbnb world where you can kind of make a little extra here and there, which was nice.
Yeah. And I'm kind of interested. We'll have to kind of circle back to this later as you kind of move up the system and have systems in place, but probably just by having done every aspect of this, it really helped you down the road build those systems that I was just referring to.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's easier to train a cleaner if you've been the cleaner and also just appreciate how hard it is, because cleaning is like, it's super intense. It could be like backbreaking work and it can also just be disheartening when someone is really disrespectful to a place or leaves it super dirty. So yeah, just kind of understanding that role.
So let's talk about subletting just for a second. So you're using this, you know, you're not buying the houses. You've rented the first place. The first place allowed you to sublet. It was a no-brainer. The second place, what happened there? Was it easy to pull off as well?
Totally. I just made sure to look over the lease and make sure subletting was okay. And I think maybe one of the places I rented along the way, it wasn't in there. And I just said, hey, you know, I travel some for work, which was true. I was traveling a lot. It wasn't really for work, but it was just for fun. And, you know, I want to be able to like rent it out when I'm gone or something like that. And they were cool with it. And of course, this is like before people knew about Airbnb. So they didn't exactly know how I was doing it. But nowadays, this is like a big term that people use, and it's called master leasing, where you get the approval of the landlord to be doing Airbnb in their space. And so it's a great way to do it if you don't have as much money to just buy a place. So a lot of people are using that, and they have 100 places that they just master lease. So it's definitely something really good that you can use.
Okay. At this point, you've got two of these apartments, I guess, as I understand it. Are there like 4 bedrooms total?
Yeah, that was 4 bedrooms. And eventually I moved from that 2-bedroom one that I just got to a 1-bedroom one and stayed in that one for a while. So I kind of hopped around. It was like improving upon the property based on where it was located. And that first apartment that I rented was kind of like a basement apartment. So I wanted to get something nicer. So between 2012 and 2014, when I bought my first place, I just kind of hopped around between like maybe 3 apartments or something like that.
That sounds like a pretty cool life, as you've described it almost. Like you're living out of a suitcase. It sounds like if one of the bedrooms was vacant that night, you would sleep there. If
it's
not,
just perfect utilization.
Right? Yeah, like you'd stay with friends. I mean, like, sure, this is a pretty transient existence, but it sounds cool. You're describing like going on hikes with some of the people who are staying there. What was going on in your life at that point? Because it does sound like a fun time.
Yeah, well, I was in school for the first like year and a half of it, something like that, maybe a little longer. And so I don't know if you were, I shouldn't say if you remember, but college feels like a long time ago for me. And I just remember how flexible that kind of lifestyle is, you know, like you're available at weird times in the middle of the day and all of that. So it's kind of fun to have somebody that was like down to go on adventures. And it was also really easy for me to schedule cleaning. So depending on the day, you know, I might have one place to clean, I might have a couple hours of class, and then just like enjoying life. So it was a really sweet, mellow time.
I would love to talk about your cash flow situation, you know, for that period of time with 3 apartments, and you are somewhat consistently having them rented out on Airbnb. What sort of profit were you making month to month?
So I only ever had 2 at a time at that early stage, just because it was kind of like, I didn't have the mentality like build, and I was just sort of trying to do it all myself, which is kind of a Mr. Money Mustache tenant of like, do everything yourself and like, don't outsource and don't pay people. It took me a minute, but I had to learn that like, actually, if I'm going to grow this to anything, I do have to outsource. So those early years, I was just bootstrapping all of the roles, which I don't recommend to people if they want to build something. So at about 2013, I had 2 1-bedroom apartments. So I kind of had moved apartments a little bit, and I was sort of at that spot. At that time, I was making both apartments profit about $1,000 a month. So again, it wasn't crazy money, but I was covering both of the rents, and I was still able to live at this really frugal stage of $2,000 to $2,500 a month once your rent is covered.
Wow.
So I was still able to like save, pay off some student loans, and yeah, just live kind of frugal.
So 2014, you buy your first house. And although I am not an experienced real estate investor, I do understand that there's a difference in financing for people that are going to be the primary resident and the financing for somebody that is an investor. You're just going to get access to different rates. And in order to get the best rates, usually you're bringing cash to the table. And so I'm just curious, you know, as someone that's bringing in around $2,000 a month from your prior experience, but you're using that to cash flow your life to some varying degree. Did you finance your first property using traditional primary resident financing or something else?
Yeah, I didn't do that. I was like, I was listening to your whole question build up, and I was like, dang, I'm going to destroy this question. So the problem there that a lot of people don't think about is when you're working for yourself, it's a really hard situation to get a loan. It's like you can do it, but you have to go there with, you know, lots of tax returns, all of your bank statements, everything, because you don't have this like simple W-2, I've been working at the same job and had the same salary for 4 years. So I knew that was going to be a pain in the butt. And I thought, okay, I'm going to have to get creative with this if I want to do it. But I also had this great experience of working with Airbnb and knowing what a one bedroom rents for in Boulder and what I can make. And I knew the seasons, like I knew everything at that point. And so I felt really confident about knowing what I could cover. And I felt like that was a real gift. So for me, I actually had one of my landlord friends. So he was like an old landlord of mine from like a couple years prior. And we still hung out sometimes. And he owned like 17 apartments in the same building. And he was just kind of an OG real estate investor guy. And I had kind of heard that he'd given people loans in the past. And so I just like got up the courage and went and asked. And I was pretty nervous, but I had all my numbers and I was just kind of like, you know I can cover this. And he asked me just very basic questions like, how much do you make a month and what are you doing and what's your plan? He kind of worked with me step by step through like the inspection and everything. And he was so into it. So I really feel grateful. I mean, I definitely think there were a lot of places along the way that I had a lot of luck, but, that was my first step. So it was really easy.
See, I want to slow down on this because I feel like a lot of times in life, people, they have these ideas, but they don't take action. A lot of times it's because they're scared. They're scared to have that conversation, whether it's looking to find a new job or asking for a raise, putting yourself in that place and saying like, how do you get up the courage to have that meeting with that investor, this landlord? Do you remember how you even broached the subject? Like, hey, you want to get together? Or, hey, I need a loan. I mean, do you remember that? Because I found in life, the little things are the big things, especially when it's getting over that hurdle of not taking action, or sometimes these little things can really help people.
Yeah. I mean, I remember how nervous I was for sure. I also remember like where we had the conversation. It was like on his deck overlooking the river. It was like a very peaceful, beautiful spot. I don't remember exactly what I said to him, but I know that it was something I was practicing in the shower. Like I had really been thinking about this and I just felt like this is going to be my way. And up until that point, I was looking at a lot of different options. Like Boulder has a really cool affordable program, but you have to follow all these steps. I was definitely like researching all the different things I could do, but it seemed like his was going to be my best bet. So it was my first plan A. But it wasn't my only plan. So I think that's like a good thing to have in your mind is that if this is going to fail, what's the next one? But don't be afraid to do it because all I could say was no. It's not like I was going to go to jail or something, you know? It was just like, okay, I got to do the next thing. But I asked him for $144,000, which to me was like $1 million. And he said yes. So, I mean, it is amazing.
Yeah, I love that. All he could say is no. That's the worst that could have happened. So why not do it? Yeah, I absolutely love that. So talk me through. So 144K, is this like a 30-year loan? I don't mean to ask a naive question, but like I'm just don't know that much about real estate investing. Did you always intend on refinancing X number of years down the road? Talk me through the actual specifics of a loan like that.
Yeah. So the way we did it, because he's kind of older, he was like, you know, I just want like a really simple loan. So I think it was 3 years, which is pretty short, and it was a 5% interest only loan. So in general, you know, interest only loans were like the loans that they stopped doing that got people in kind of a bad spot back in the day, because at the end of that loan, you still owe $144,000. So you haven't paid any principal off. But those are really common for fix and flip kind of people or whatnot, where it's sort of just this bridge to get you to a place where you can refinance later or take out a HELOC or whatever you want to do, which is a home equity line of credit. So there are ways to pay it off, but I don't qualify for a loan now, but I'm doing all these great things to be in that place. And he actually didn't know I was doing Airbnb. I was just pitching him as like, you know, a person that wants to get into their first place. Will you help me?
Well, you know, so many people just think there's kind of two options. All right. So I can either pay cash for a house or I can, get a traditional loan, like what you did, going through a private lender, completely different conversation. Like, and how did you convince him to, you know, lend you this money? I think there's something here just for our audience to realize it's rarely binary. You know, there's probably an additional solution if you're willing to look at the problem a little bit differently, but practically, what did this conversation with this fellow actually look like? Did he give you this, you know, private loan based on your past experience with Airbnb? Did he give you the loan based on your plans to Airbnb out this unit?
Yes. First thing is that actually he didn't know I was doing Airbnb because I felt weird telling him about it. I don't know. He's just like so old school. I felt like I wasn't like, I don't know. He didn't know that. He knew that I was doing massage at the time. And so when I talked to him, I was quoting the numbers of what I was making with massage and Airbnb. So I was saying like, oh yeah, I make like 3,000 a month and the payment was only going to be $900. But I knew from renting another apartment 5 minutes away that I was paying $1,100 a month. And I knew that like, okay, 900 is going to be even cheaper. And I've been covering that like gangbusters, like above and beyond. Sometimes making 4,000 a month with my Airbnb income. So I was like, yeah, totally, that'll work. So I had the numbers going in my head, but he didn't really know. He was more just like going based off of my character of knowing me a long time and seeing that I was like making enough money. So he did not know
that you had any real estate experience. This was going to be your first deal. Wow.
It was really just that I was going to live there. And I did. I mean, I lived in that apartment for like 4 years, but I also Airbnb'd it. But it was totally my primary residence. And I took it as that. I ended up, again, being really lucky that at the time that I bought, within a year, things in Boulder blew up like 18%. I think he also had an idea that that might happen. Because when I talked to him, he said, yeah, you know, I've been noticing that homes have gone up steadily, but apartments have not. And so I foresee a big bump in apartments. And so he felt kind of comfortable with me buying an apartment, knowing that that might happen, just having been in real estate for already 30 something years. So I was also lucky to have his knowledge.
Was there any other upside for him on this? Or was it just simply, hey, I've got some cash lying around, I can get 5% interest for it for 3 years. Was that it? Or were there other terms?
Nope, that was it. He's not a guy that does anything in the stock market. If you talk to him about the stock market, he's like, no, that's scam, blah, blah, blah. You know, he's an old guy. But for me, like I believed in both. But for him, he just had a lot of money sitting in the bank, knowing that he'd rather have it loaned out because he could get a certain percentage on it. So for him, he's making $900 a month that was just sitting in a bank account. So that was kind of a win. And I also think he just likes helping people, which is awesome.
You know, what's so interesting about this is when you went to him that for that first deal, you felt like you were asking for the impossible, right? $144,000 feels like $1 million. How could I even dare to ask this? But I bet you now, as you get farther down on this journey, people almost come to you asking you to take their money, to have this sort of, you know, I'm just thinking of that $900 a month that he was making on this, on a property, you know, it's backed up by an actual piece of property and the numbers are great. Do you find that it's almost the other way where you almost have to say, no, I'm not looking to scale further?
Yeah, there are a lot of people that come to me, but I don't know them. And I have had a bad experience with buying someone I didn't know that well. And it can be very complicated. You know, I don't want a deal where there's more than one person involved. So I have pitched a lot of people in my time. And I've also said no to a lot of people because especially if you're in a home long term, which is the way I look at buying places, it's like getting married. I'm going to own this home for the rest of my life, potentially. Do I want to be entangled with this person that long?
All right, Ziana, I'm just trying to get a place on this. So you now have this first home that you own. You had these two other apartments. Are you still doing them through Airbnb? Talk me through where you are precisely then. And then at some point, the light bulb hits. This is a real business. How do you move forward from just these couple of local properties?
Yeah. So when I bought the one place, I was kind of still in this weird mentality of keeping it small and that two was really easy because I could go between the two living where I had to live. So I let one of the leases go and I owned the one and I still had another one. And so they were just two one-bedroom apartments, 5 minutes away from each other, super easy to clean and get to. But at the same time, that original friend that told me about Airbnb, he's been a longtime friend since high school. He had a friend in LA that was, I don't know if he was subletting or managing or whatnot, but he had like 7 places going at the same time. And that sounded crazy. It sounded amazing. I couldn't believe that someone could do that many, like how much work that could possibly be. And, you know, now I manage 25 or something, but I just started these ideas of like, okay, what would it look like if there were more? And could I let go of massage, or could I be like fully retired and get to those goals if I had a couple more? So it was starting to like rumble in my mind a little bit.
So again, kind of, you know, what's next at this point from a cash flow perspective, depending on kind of where you are in the season, you have somewhere between 1 and 3 properties. Now for the first time, you have your own place, but you're continuing to scale. Where do you go from here?
Yeah. So I bought my place in September, 2014. And then in 2015, I had a friend, another friend from high school that had been living in St. Louis for a few years. And I was just kind of like itching to visit. And she was saying, oh, great. You know, actually, we're going to get married, so you can just come then. That'd be a good time. And so that was June 2015. And when I went out there, you know, I could kind of heard from her that like, oh, St. Louis is really affordable. You know, my rent's like $400 and whatnot compared to like, I'm used to paying like over 1,000. So I kind of had that in my mind, like, oh, that's cool. It's affordable. But like St. Louis, I don't know anything about this place. So then I'm at the wedding, small talking with people and telling them like, yeah, you know, I do Airbnb. And they were saying, oh, you know, our friends do really well with it here. And we've been thinking about it because our mortgage is like $300. Wow. And I was like, what? You know, and they're talking like a 3-bedroom house. You know, my mortgage was like almost $1,000 for a 1-bedroom apartment. At that moment, I decided like, I'm going to buy a house here. And so after the wedding, I went home and I sat on it for 2 weeks. I just said, you know, is this a good idea? What am I doing? Am I crazy? And then after the 2 weeks, I was like, yep, I'm doing it. And I spent those 2 weeks buying a place. So I was back there a month later with my place in January, like furnishing.
Did you know that this was an in-demand area? I mean, that there would be people that would be looking for short-term rentals, like, you know, in terms of guiding light, someone that wants to buy, you know, I could go buy something in the desert for even less, but how do I know anybody will want to go there? Like, how do you, you know, you don't live there. You don't know the environment super well. How do you assess whether or not that could actually work?
At the wedding, I got a couple of numbers, you know, between my friend who was getting married, she knew a bunch of people. And then I just kind of talked to a couple of people that were actually doing Airbnb, and they were really, you know, friendly and not competitive or anything. And so they were just saying, you know, this is why it works in our area. These are the kind of numbers we're seeing, you know, and some of them didn't own, they were just renting. And so I just got like an idea of numbers. And then when I went back home, there's so much you can do just on the computer. So I like to use Trulia for crime maps. I was using Google Maps just to like do the street view where you can kind of walk down the street just to see like, oh, are the homes all boarded up or is this a nice looking neighborhood? Just getting a little gist of it. And then there was a lot of information. St. Louis is kind of a collection of small neighborhoods. And so I was kind of reading about the different neighborhoods and trying to get an idea of what brings people to town. And ultimately, what I landed on is that I'm used to Boulder being a college town, and I knew the college had enough weight to bring in, you know, students and teachers and parents and lots of activities. And so I thought, okay, let me get to the biggest school in St. Louis and try to be there near like a cool street. So there's this street called The Loop that has like all the restaurants and a movie theater and like music hall and different stuff, shops and whatnot. So most of my homes are right there. And the last thing I thought about is that students don't really care. So it's not like living next to a little old lady who's going to be watching you and like ratting you out. I thought, okay, if I live next to students, people are coming and going. They don't really watch. They don't care. So I knew that was probably like a good plan.
You're saying students don't care about Airbnb tenants. So like if you went to a suburban neighborhood and someone's like, oh my goodness, look at all these people coming in and out over and over again, there might be some sort of issue. But in a student area, you're absolutely right. They're just going to and from class. They're basically transient themselves every 2 years or every year, maybe even. They're just not going to really care about short-term tenants.
Totally. And they've got their friends coming and going. Like, yeah, it's just not, it's not the same culture, I would say.
And this was definitely still the plan to do Airbnb, not to do student rentals, right? Because you had done all this research. It sounds like the perfect place for a student rental, But you still, the plan was all along Airbnb.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think only now I'm a little more comfortable with the idea of long-term, but back then it was pretty scary still. Evictions and not knowing the laws of what rights you have as like a tenant versus a landlord. I mean, there's just so much stuff about long-term that I didn't understand and was not comfortable with. With Airbnb, they pay you before they even arrive. So there's no like hassle with rent. People are only there a couple of days. There's a lot less damage. There's just so many things that I didn't want to worry about. So Airbnb is what I knew, and I knew that I could do good there with it. So yeah, I wasn't really worried about that.
Awesome. Well, let's go back and just to talk just for a second about the numbers of this deal, of this home that you actually purchased. So you said, you know, mortgage payments in this area were $300 a month compared to your property in Boulder, where you're paying over $1,000 a month. So, you know, a lot of people talk about the 1% rule. Can you get at least 1% of your money back in rent? If you were going to tie that to what you were seeing with this Airbnb property in St. Louis, what sort of percent rule were you hitting? What were the numbers on this deal after you've got it up and running?
Yeah, so when I was analyzing the numbers of this place, I wanted to make sure that at my fallback plan, that I would be able to at least hit that 1%. The place, I purchased it for $72,000. It was a 3-bedroom with a garage, front and backyard. I knew that I could probably get at least $800 to $1,000 a month in normal rent, like long-term rent. And so I felt pretty comfortable with that. Worst case scenario, if I've got to rent it long-term, I can get that. The problem there is that it's maybe like a B or C neighborhood. And so I would say that the type of tenants I might get in that neighborhood, it might not be exactly the type of tenant I wanted to deal with. So I still don't really want to rent long term, but I know that I can if I had to.
But you went the Airbnb route. And so what did you see from a performance aspect with this particular property?
Yeah. So what I was thinking is that I could probably get close to $100 a night. And so if that's the case, I'm going to be able to cover my mortgage in like 3 or 4 nights. So how can I go wrong, even if it's got less demand than Boulder? You know, because my mortgage ended up being, well, it wasn't really a mortgage because, again, I had a private loan, but I did, it was $333.33. That was my mortgage. I love it. Yeah, I was just like, okay, I think I can cover this. And, you know, I actually went like a really weird route. I ended up, instead of renting it as one full property, because I didn't know anyone in St. Louis and I was kind of concerned about how I was going to hire a cleaner and have someone who was dependable, I ended up having someone live there full time who was paying discounted rent. And then they were renting out the 2 bedrooms. So I was still controlling it, but they were the live-in kind of host slash cleaner. And that made decent money. But I just this last year switched it to being just a full-time rental on its own, and it makes better money now. So I don't think I'd recommend that. But at the time, I was like, how do I know someone's actually going to show up and clean? You know, I was really kind of worried about that. So having someone live there, it made it really easy to know that I had a dependable person.
Awesome. All right. I would love to move into kind of best practices for Airbnb, but just for the sake of the audience, kind of understanding how far you've taken this, how many properties do you own currently? And I think you said on top of that, you're also managing even more. So yeah, just kind of where are you at now with your journey in real estate?
I own 6 properties now and I manage, yeah, it's usually like 20 to 25. It changes a lot depending on the season. So I've probably managed 50 places, but yeah, they turn off, people move, they change what they want to do. So it's an ever-changing business.
So real quick, Sienna, what does manage mean in the terms of Airbnb? This is not the old days where you have a lease on the place and you're running it entirely, or is it? Or are you actually just managing someone else's place and just getting a street management fee?
I would say there's 3 ways to get into Airbnb. You can buy a place, which is the most expensive way. So say, you know, you have to put down like $40,000 in a deposit and all the expenses of a mortgage and then furnish it. So that's a lot. Then you can do the master leasing, which is like rent to rent. You know, you get the owner's permission and that's a lot cheaper because you're doing first month's rent, last month's rent and furniture, which, you know, maybe is more like $10,000. But if you literally have like no money, you can manage for someone else where you put no money into it. they own the home. It's either their primary residence and they're traveling, or it's just a vacation home and they have furnished it and everything. And you just take a percentage off the top. So we charge 20%. I've seen people charge up to 40 or 50%, depending on what services you offer. And that's a really easy way to get into it. Usually you'd want some experience first, but yeah, you don't have to have any money in the game.
Yeah, that's amazing. So 20% of gross revenue and no skin in the game at all. So you've built out an Airbnb system, right? Like at this point, you know these best practices and like people are just leveraging your skills to help them earn more money. Like, is that a pretty good summation of what's going on?
Yeah. I mean, over time, I've really learned how to automate. And as I grew up in Airbnb, the system also grew up. So I've been in it over 7 years now, and there's tons of different softwares to automate now. You know, at the time that I started, there was really nothing. Now, I mean, there's so many cool apps for cleaners, for receptionists, for just all kinds of automated messages and different things. So my business can run pretty hands-off and it's very low hours a week. And I've even outsourced a bunch to an assistant. So it's really where I can kind of step away and do almost nothing if I want to.
This is awesome. Okay. So our audience, I'm sure they're as inspired by your story as I am, and Brad too. I don't want to leave you out, Brad. You're welcome. But what I want to dig into is actually kind of pick your brain and get some of these actionable steps that someone that actually maybe now for the first time has their first Airbnb, they've run the numbers, they have it. I want to talk a little bit about running an awesome Airbnb. And so the first thing that comes to mind is you have a property and it's empty. I mean, is this like straight, let's go to IKEA? Like, what do you do?
You know, I think that's the best thing about Airbnb is everybody lives somewhere. Even if you lived in a van, you can Airbnb that, you know. I've also heard of people renting like a tent in their backyard, and that's something that you can rent. So you have something now that you can test it out with. So if you thought, maybe I want to be a property manager, yeah, you can just try it now with your own space. And there are a lot of people that have, like if you live in the Midwest and you have a lot more space, you have a spare bedroom, you have a basement that you could furnish. There's lots of other things that you can rent out. And so just getting the experience hosting, seeing if that's something you like. I love that about Airbnb. That's like easy to just start.
And how much does it cost you to furnish like your St. Louis house?
I do it really cheap because I love furnishing. I think it's like one of the most fun things that I get to do in this business. I furnished that house, I want to say between like $4,000 and $5,000. Actually, maybe it was a little bit less, but I use Craigslist. I go to garage sales. I go to all the like consignment stores and thrift stores and get stuff that way because I love finding and hunting. It's like the art of the deal kind of thing, negotiating and stuff. And also like doing Craigslist, I got to learn the city in a lot of cool ways, just driving around, picking up stuff in all these different neighborhoods and pockets. So that was really valuable for me. I also hear about people who just buy everything new and it shows up and then they have just kind of like a build everything party. And that works too, you know, but I think that costs a lot more, but it saves you in time. So it really depends on like what your goals are and what you have access to. But for me, I love the fun of like getting all these unique pieces and going to antique malls and all that.
Nice. Yeah, that's really cool. So I get that if you're running one or two, if you are building this out as like a scalable business, are there best practices that you would look for? Like, I can't imagine you would spend 30 hours rummaging through St. Louis trying to find stuff, or maybe you would. Honestly.
Oh, she would, Brad. But she would.
But I do.
Oh, that's so cool. Okay. All right. Well, then I stand corrected. But are there stores that people generally focus on? Like Jonathan mentioned IKEA before, or are there, I guess, even just like a bare minimum expectation of the furnishing? It's probably the most succinct way to ask my question.
Yes. Antique stores, yeah. Craigslist, garage sales. Where are the hotspots?
Yeah. So for me, because I'm buying less places, you know, like I buy and then furnish. So I only own six. I might have furnished a couple other rentals for other people, but it's not like such high volume that I continue to go to Craigslist and do that because it's fun. But for other people that I've met along the way that have like 100 and they're all master leased, they have to furnish it all themselves. So they have a relationship with some kind of wholesale furniture place. So yeah, I mean, you could make a relationship with IKEA, but the problem with IKEA is their furniture is very identifiable. And then if your entire house looks like IKEA, it's a little bit boring. I'm not a huge fan. I've had some IKEA things, you know, I have a couch or something here and there, but I try not to be too IKEA. I think there's other stores that could work. People get stuff from Wayfair or different companies, but I think the ones that do it big, they just have a certain relationship. And then they also have a team. That's the furnishing building team. And they just get everything delivered. So it's not even like them being involved in that at all. It sort of depends on like what's fun for you. And I think if you're going back to the financial independence, early retirement kind of lifestyle, I only want to do the fun parts.
Yeah.
So that for me is fun.
And you mentioned team, like we're talking about scale here. You're a distance Airbnb landlord, or I don't know if landlord's the right term, but we're going to go with it. You're doing this from a distance. You have to have a team. What does your team look like now? And who should people be looking for to have a solid team to do this?
So it's actually, when you're first starting, pretty easy. The only people you need is like a cleaner or two. And sometimes you can just hire like a cleaning company and then they have lots of cleaners. And then a handyman, just like a dependable guy, which you can find online or in a newspaper, but you can also just ask a bunch of people around and get a name. But yeah, if you have those two, you're pretty much good to go. That's another thing I love about Airbnb. It's pretty simple. Even from afar, it's the same team that you would build locally. And you don't need like a huge renovation squad, like if you were flipping homes or something.
Who's that like call person? You know, put yourself in this situation. Something's gone wrong. Something isn't there. Who handles it for you? And how do you find that person?
I've developed my cleaners to be that person. Essentially, if someone can't figure out how to get in the house or some kind of emergency, it's usually that the cleaners, they make a certain rate each time they clean. But if I need them to go run like an emergency thing, it's like a $20 an hour deal. And then they just bill me separately for that. So it's pretty easy. I find that like the best fit for something like that is not a person who's just going to go to the house to clean, but someone who understands that this is like their house. You know, they have a relationship with the home. They notice when something's out of place when they go there. They're not just crossing things off the checklist and then leaving the house. They're really like care for it. And so it is kind of different. You know, it's almost like a different kind of role to hire for.
What do you ask when you're hiring somebody to find that kind of level of ownership in someone who's going to ultimately be a cleaner at heart? What do you ask? How do you get to the bottom of that?
I think it's asking kind of like why. What do people like about it? And there are a lot of people that just do it because they feel like they can't do anything else. And sadly, that's not always your best bet. It's finding those people who love to clean, that they like to make a space nice, that they notice like, wow, it just feels like uplifted and maybe like vibrationally higher being in a space that's clean and everything is attuned. You know, there are people that just have like a love, a deep love for that. And they're kind of more caretakers of the land. And so it's really talking to that person and getting their world. I thought, oh yeah, you just hire a cleaner or whatever. And now I'm really realizing like you need someone who has the care. It's about hiring attitudes. Like I learned this from Southwest, the founder of Southwest just died and they did this huge cover on him and he's just super inspiring. But it's about hiring the attitude and just knowing that you can train for the skills if you've got the right person. And so it's not about just saying like, oh, okay, I need, you know, someone who's perfect in these ways. It's like also just hiring somebody who has this brightness and easy to work with and easy to communicate with. And they're just like happy and love what they're doing. That's the kind of person I want to find.
What about the other half of that? So once you have that place looking perfect, how do you actually make your listing stand out, right? I mean, you're putting this onto Airbnb and now there's 50 Airbnbs in your neighborhood. How do you make sure that yours is the one that's grabbed?
I think that starts with furnishing. People will furnish the way that they live and it's a little beige on beige or like really thrown together, like very college dorm looking. And that's not really going to work as well. People want the pops of color and they want the unique pieces and they just kind of want to like live in something that maybe is not even their style, but they want to try something on. So I find that if you can have really interesting things in the photos, art and lots of textures, like fuzzy rugs or like a nice throw or something that just like makes it feel really cozy and a place you want to be, that really comes across in the photos. So furnishing is the first step. Photos are really important. We do just take placeholder photos with our phones when we're first started, but then you always get those professional photos in the next week or so once it's all done. So that's really important because what it's turned into is kind of like house porn. People just want to click around, even if they can't afford that house. They want to like look at everything and see what it would be like to live in it. What people don't notice or don't know is that that's part of the SEO for Airbnb. So if someone's just clicking around on your listing, even if they don't book it, it's making you show up higher in the search. If they wish list you, which is kind of putting in a saved folder, that makes you show up higher. So you want that.
So one major aspect, obviously, of the listing is the pricing. How do you set that? What kind of research do you do? Talk me through how you would even go about doing that.
Yeah, so I used to do pricing on my own, but now there's so many sophisticated services that do it that I just use one of the algorithm kind of sites. They kind of connect in with my property management software and they do it all automatically. So I do go in and tweak it. I probably look at it every week or so, but it's not much that I have to do. The most that I'm setting is just like discounts. If it's getting to be like a last minute booking or something, those like lower the price, but pretty much the algorithm can see other hotels, other Airbnbs, what events are going on in town, what kind of demand there is. So it's really sharp.
So you're describing this third party platform that's there to help you. It sounds like Airbnb has some algorithms that almost determine SEO, like where things show up. How do you learn this? How did you learn it? If someone was starting today, like, can you point them in the direction? Like, we're all about those actionable tips. Someone's listening to this and is going to start Airbnb in the next month because of you. How do they get started?
Airbnb can be both. It can be super basic and easy, and then it can be like super sophisticated and scientific and detailed if you get to that place. What I'd say is to avoid the analysis paralysis is just don't get too heady about it. Do your best with what you have. You know, stage the place, make it nice, fluff the pillows, get as best photos as you can. If you can get them professional, do it. Airbnb offers a discounted professional photographer to come out and it's deducted from your earnings. So that's kind of convenient. So you don't really pay for it until you've already booked some guests. And then it can get more specific. But with someone just starting, I would say get it live. Just do Airbnb for now because there's lots of other websites, but I find that's the best and easiest to use. And then get pricing software. So just those two. Airbnb offers a pricing software, but I think it's really bad. So don't use Airbnbs. And I say, even if you have one property, get the pricing software because it's worth it. And it's probably only around like 1% of your income. That's generally how they do the pricing on that. But just those two services is enough. If you get to a place where you've got 5 or 10 and you really want to manage, then you can get property management software and it automates so many more things. But just to start, get those two things and hire your first cleaner. You don't even need a handyman until you have a problem. But it is kind of nice to preemptively have a name.
If you can get to the place where you have 6 properties with an Airbnb, like how much are you cash flowing each month on that?
I mean, my goal is really to have each place do at least $1,000 profit a month. So that's where I look at numbers in the general sense of the word. But my places in St. Louis, they fluctuate. Everything fluctuates. They generally do $1,600 a month in the slow season and then $3,000 or something in the high season. And that's not with the expenses taken out. I think expenses are like $500 a month or something like that. Sometimes it's more, but I hope for $1,000 a month. I really aim for that. And yes, sometimes it's more. My property in Boulder, sometimes it's $4,000 a month in the summer, height of the height. And then in the winter, yeah, it's more like $16,000 to $18,000 or something. So you have to kind of know your seasons. That's something you just kind of learn. But pretty much everywhere, summer is a very busy time. So like right now, going into like spring, summer, it's so great. This is the time to really get started if anyone's interested, because you get the momentum of the high season coming and then all of the reviews and experience that will carry you through the winter season. You don't want to start in like November. That'd just be sad.
Hey, Ziana, real quick, what's the name of that pricing software? Do you know that offhand?
I like Beyond Pricing, but there's quite a few. And on my website, I have a tools or resources section. And if you go through my website, they'll give you like a free month, which is awesome.
Nice. And we'll definitely link to ZianaMcIntyre.com in the show notes for sure.
And what's so interesting to me is you've built this skill set, you've built this portfolio of properties, but arguably, like long-term, it's the skill set. It's a fact that you actually have figured out how to do less work. It's a fact that you have figured out how to automate things and to build a team. You have these six properties, and then you have this business that's running parallel that's solving this same set of problems for way more individuals. And that is what is really remarkable to me. Now, on most shows, that would be the end of the episode. But Ziana, on this show, we would love to give you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
Yeah, let's do it.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Ziana, question number one, your favorite blog that's not your own.
Well, this is no surprise. Mr. Money Mustache is my favorite.
Awesome. Well, I guess question number two, and you're more than welcome to give us more than one answer for this, your favorite article of all time. This could be one that you wrote if there's something on ZianaMcIntyre.com, or you could point to one on Pete's site if there was one in particular that kind of sparked that light bulb for you.
I do really like one on Pete's site, and it's the one that I recommend to people most, is the 4% rule. It just talks about how much you need for retirement. And I think that's like really freeing for so many people that think, oh, I need $1 million or $3 million or something. And you could actually see what you spend and then see how much you would need to make for the rest of your life. It's really nice to be like, wow, that number is only a couple hundred thousand or something. And I think it gives people just a lot more space.
I love that because to me, it's about controlling what you can control, right? And when you have that sense of, okay, this all drives off of my expenses. Well, then I know what my number is, as opposed to it being this crazy nebulous Susie Orman, I need $10 million to retire type thing. Your brain shuts off when you hear that. But when it drives off of your expenses, that's something that you have control of. And to me, that's really liberating.
Yeah.
All right. Question number three, your favorite life hack.
I love credit cards. I always get really sad when I see a friend pay with a debit card. I'm like, no. I just love like points, miles, like all the perks, like the lounges. I mean, I just feel like so fancy. It's definitely stuff like I wouldn't pay for on my own, but because I get to use all the credit cards, it's like I get so much cool stuff. And I know like Brad knows all about that more than I do, but I definitely utilize it.
I actually want to like highlight that just for a second, just because you are a little bit of a digital nomad in that you have built a business. You're no longer tied to a property. You have a team in place to automate the day to day. I mean, have you done some pretty cool trips with points?
Yeah. You know, I travel like 6 months a year. It's a lot. I'm pretty much gone once a month for a week to 10 days and the next couple of months. And so it's always like I've got something to look forward to. And I have so many fun travel friends that I've met along the way that I'm always getting all these invites to go all these places. And it's almost hard to stay home. So it is really fun that it's really no different. Maybe the time difference is a little annoying, but if I've got my whole team in place, I just answer emails and stuff wherever I am. It's no big deal.
Brad can't say that. he may know a lot of academia, but he's been able to carve out you're at 2 months a year now, right, Brad? Almost 2 months a year that you can travel.
Yes, I am definitely getting there. My kids have this very intense swim season, so they just love their swimming. And for us to take them away from it would be difficult. So yeah, the month of August is definitely like a red X month, and we just pick up and travel. We're going to Maui this year for 3+ weeks, I think. And yeah, we try to get some other travels in during school breaks and such.
Nice. Well, I should send you my Maui recommendations. I grew up there and I have like a little list that I send everybody.
Oh, can we include that? Please send it to us. That would be awesome. Okay.
That's fun.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you.
All right. Question number four, your biggest financial mistake.
So one of the houses I bought in 2015, I bought two houses at the same time. I bought with a friend and it really didn't go well. And it was the only time that I bought with someone that it blew up in my face. And now I own three homes with two different friends and it's perfect. It's wonderful. But it just so happened that this one was not. And so we didn't have really solid contracts because I was just like, oh, he's a friend of mine. It'll be easy. But it ended up being a bit of a lawsuit and so much mess at the end of it all. So I would really recommend having good contracts, even if it's like your boyfriend.
Awesome. Question number five, the advice you would give your younger self.
I would buy newer homes. I have a few homes that are 100 years old, and it's just so much maintenance. I would like look more at the 10-year-old homes. And I know everybody's like, oh, but old homes have charm. Charm's expensive. I'm like all about the newer places. So I'm not about to sell my places, but the next things I buy, I'm looking for newer. And the other thing I would say as like an Airbnb host is always buy two bathrooms. I have a lot of places that are like two bed, one bath. But if a toilet breaks down and they don't have another toilet, it is legit an emergency, you know? So I'm like two bathrooms always going forward.
I actually do want to ask you one more follow-up on that. And it's tied to that particular answer. Like, are there any areas of the country or specific things that we talked about, college towns being a good indicator, you know, that it might work for Airbnb? I live in Richmond, Virginia. We're a college town, you know, like is there any reason that you would either shy away from an area or even inside of a sector? So more specific than that, you're inside a neighborhood, you know, everything generally looks good, but you're like, no, I don't think I want to get this type of property. Any kind of warning signs there?
Yeah, I mean, I would say now that there's so many laws against Airbnb, depending on the actual city, that's the main thing. It's like anybody who tells me like, oh, I've been looking in this area, I'm like, look at the laws first, then look at properties. You need to check that out because you really don't want to be somewhere that's super unfriendly. It's not fun to have to be like sneaking around or trying to like do things in a gray area. It's just better to find a place where it's green lighted.
Yeah, that's great advice. All right, Zianna, we got one last bonus question for you. What's the purchase that you've made in, let's say, roughly the last 12 months that has added the most value to your life?
Yeah, it's hard to say one, but I'd say in general, like for me, it's always travel and personal development workshops. I'm kind of a geek for workshops. So it's really fun to kind of just learn more about myself and grow. But it's really experiences. You know, I find that it's hard for me to buy anything for my house or for myself anymore. It's so much of my stuff is like hand-me-downs from friends because I just don't need things. I just love being out in the world and like doing stuff.
This episode has been so awesome. We're so grateful for you coming on the show and sharing your story with our community. Someone's listening to this and they want to connect with you, one, because they have an Airbnb that they want you to manage, or two, they want to find out more about just your story or just how to get started with Airbnb. What is the best way for someone to connect with you?
Through my website, ZiannaMcIntyre.com.
Awesome. Zianna, thank you so much for coming on the show today. This has been fantastic.
Thanks, guys.
You know, Brad, for me, the thing is, how often in my own life have I looked at something and I said, you know, that sounds so great, but I'm not going to do it until I thoroughly understand the ins and outs. I'm going to analyze this, get all the information. I'm going to have the perfect system in place before I do my first real estate deal. But while I was listening to all, still continuing to listen to all these shows, perfecting my perfect plan, Zianna took action and look what she has created with that first step and beyond.
Yeah, it's really pretty amazing. And yeah, she just jumped in with both feet and let's do this. Let's experiment. Let's see what happens. It was a fun adventure for her, right? And it turned into this amazing life. But who knows, right? It could have just been that fun little adventure renting out her second bedroom in that first apartment. But where was the harm in that? She looked at basically capping her downside. It was only a couple $100 a month. And if it didn't work for a month or two, then you stop. What a cool way to go through life and to just really dive into something and just experiment. So yeah, I mean, it's really a wonderful story. And obviously what she's built now is really incredibly impressive. I'd love to, maybe we could get her back on in a Friday roundup down the road and talk about like very specific tactics that she uses for Airbnb, you know, if there's some interest there. But yeah, this was just a great, great overview of how you get into this.
If you got value from today's episode, and if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second and press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. Just lets the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us in what we're doing here at Choose FI, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. To do that, just go to choosefi.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to choosefi.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 100. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth one life hack at a time.